Chapter 10. The Autism Question. You don't talk about autism in the U.S. It's too politically charged, Mikovits claims Coffin told him. She believes Coffin turned against her that very day. Coffin confirms he was upset that Lombardi presented such preliminary data on such a fraught topic, but says, I did not turn against Judy at that or any other point. John Cohen and Martin Ensering, False Positive, Science. On October 14, 2009, Mikovits and Annette Whittemore surprised the ME/CFS community when they appeared on a show called Nevada Newsmakers and introduced the compelling possibility on air that there was a connection between not just XMRV and ME/CFS, but also autism. The WPI had been interested in both autism and Gulf War syndrome as apparent neuroimmune diseases. Mikovits believed that autism involved a dysregulation of the immune and nervous systems. Despite the dissent of one of the WPI advisors, Mikovits kept pursuing the idea. She then chanced upon a pertinent article from the Department of Medical Microbiology and Immunology at the University of California at Davis. A study overseen by Dr. Judy Vandewater of the MIND Institute, Medical Investigation of Neurodevelopmental Disorders, investigated one of Mikovits's prime subjects, natural killer cells. The title of her paper, Altered Gene Expression and Function of Peripheral Blood Natural Killer Cells in Children with Autism, jumped out to Mikovits like a lighted billboard on a quiet road, flashing the message, Autoimmune Problem, Check for Viruses and Other Pathogens. Natural killer cells, NK, are white blood cells with a vital role in killing tumor and virally infected cells, and they were thought to be centrally involved in early cases in ME/CFS, as measured by researchers at the NCI in a paper co-authored by Cheney and Peterson in 1987. The killer cell maneuvers itself into close proximity to a cell that it has identified as being cancerous or virally infected, and then releases special proteins such as perforin and proteases known as granzymes. The perforin opens pores in the cell membrane, perforating it, and this allows the granzymes to enter. The granzymes then induce apoptosis, cell suicide, destroying the cell without releasing infectious viral particles, or virions. A body fighting off cancer or viruses desperately needs its natural killer cells to function properly. Some scientists have suggested that natural killer cells have other indispensable purposes, like modulating the immune system. Vandewater found significant differences in natural killer cell function between normal children and those with autism spectrum disorder, ASD. As she stated, this present study shows distinct and significant physiological differences in NK cell responses in children with ASD. An altered NK cell population may have several consequences which could impact upon immune function in ASD and could explain some of the immune findings previously observed in ASD. This work by Vandewater clearly revealed that mainstream researchers were investigating autism as a potential neuroimmune disorder, very much in line with the central mission statement of the WPI. The UC Davis group had found abnormal autoantibodies in the mothers of children with autism, specifically a 37 kilodalton protein that they could not identify, as well as autoantibodies in the systems of the children. Autoantibodies were already on Mikovits's radar. This expression autoantibody comes from the Greek words auto, meaning self, anti, meaning against, and body, the self turning internally against itself. The immune system manufactures a protein directed against one or more of a person's own proteins. Some autoantibody production is thought to be due to a combination of genetics and environmental triggers, such as a viral illness or exposure to certain toxic chemicals. Mikovits and Peterson thought that a protein of 37,000 molecular weight the UC Davis researchers had discovered might be directed against a part of the RNase L enzyme, indicating another weakness in the body's antiviral defense system. The enzyme was likely amorphous and broken, and the body had decided these fragments were invaders and that it should mount a defense. What could have possibly triggered such a breakdown in the RNase L enzyme? It could be caused by viral or bacterial infection, but chemical or environmental exposures were also possible. As van de Water later wrote in an article entitled "Autoantibodies to Cerebellum in Children with Autism Associated with Behavior," collectively, these data suggest that autoantibodies towards brain proteins in children are associated with lower adaptive and cognitive function, as well as core behaviors associated with autism. It is unclear whether these antibodies have direct pathogenic significance, or if they are merely a response to a previous injury. Future studies are needed to determine the identities of the protein targets and explore their significance in autism. Mikovits and Peterson traveled to visit van de Water and others at the MIND Institute to discuss these intriguing findings. At the time, Mikovits's team wasn't as focused on retroviruses, but rather on general patterns of immune system regulation suggested by the research. Overall immune dysregulation might explain the pathogens associated with neuroimmune disorders, such as HHV6 or the Epstein-Barr virus, argued as both causal and passenger viruses in ME/CFS. If a retrovirus was at the heart of various neuroimmune problems, the situation could be one of a retroviral driver and other passengers, the way the Kaposi sarcoma herpes virus, KSHV or HHV8, was a passenger in AIDS patients. While the herpes virus does not technically cause Kaposi sarcoma, a type of cancer, in healthy patients, the HIV retrovirus knocks out a part of the immune system, which allows for KS to reactivate. The MIND Institute meetings were fruitful, and it became clear to Mikovits that van de Water, her staff, and the head of the MIND Institute, David Amaral, were interested in further research. Specifically, they wanted to examine the natural killer cell defect and were intrigued by the possibility that the 37 kilodalton protein might be an antibody directed against a broken fragment of the RNase L enzyme. After an ongoing back and forth via telephone, Annette, Mikovits, and Peterson even donned formal clothes and drove down to Davis, California for the MIND Institute ball in September of 2008. The three of them were disappointed to find the ball wasn't raising funds for the biological investigations of van de Water and other researchers, but for behavior modification. "They just want to build a better wheelchair," said Annette. Annette had often used this expression to describe useless research into ME/CFS that had seemingly given up on being curative. Annette wanted to spearhead a dramatic change for these patients, not only make tiny improvements in their quality of life. One of the first pediatric cases the WPI investigated involved a family with two kids who suffered from a genetic mutation-associated disease called Niemann-Pick type C, often referred to as a kind of childhood Alzheimer's disease, due to progressive deterioration of the brain and organs caused by a buildup of lipids, which results in dementia, seizures, tremors, and other progressive symptoms. While both parents tested negative for any active XMRV virus, they tested positive for the antibody to the envelope of XMRV. The children also tested positive for XMRV envelope protein. The envelope of a virus is often used as a means of detecting the virus, although this line of testing can be imprecise because related viruses can react to the detecting reagent, that is, the antibody to SFFV envelope detects all members of the xenotropic murine leukemia viruses, including XMRV. If a virus is wearing a different envelope protein, like a suspect in a borrowed coat and hat, identification may be confusing. Mikovits and her team also found compelling overlap with other disorders. Of three patients they tested with atypical multiple sclerosis, all three were positive for antibody to XMRV envelope protein and GAG DNA, partial sequence of a structural protein of the virus. 12 out of 20 patients, 60%, with fibromyalgia were also positive for XMRV GAG DNA. The autism cohort was the largest non-ME/CFS group they investigated, and the results varied depending on which test was used. 12 out of 30 children with autism were positive for XMRV GAG DNA, or 40% positive. 23 out of 30, 76%, were positive for XMRV envelope by Western blot. 16 out of 28, 57%, were positive for serum antibody to the XMRV envelope. Depending on the test used, the autism kids showed some XMRV viral evidence from a low of 40% to a high of 76%. As they were working on more than 300 samples from ME/CFS patients, the other disorders they were investigating were more marginal interests, yet notable given the shocking data versus controls. Another paper done earlier by Dr. Paul Levine and his colleagues informed much of Mikovits's thinking. Levine had worked at the NCI at the same time as Mikovits, but they never interacted until she arrived at the WPI. Levine's study looked at several generations in a family in which one of the members had ME/CFS, and delved deeply into the question of the natural killer cell activity of specific individuals. Levine found, remarkably, that the NK cell activity level correlated with the overall severity of disease. Mikovits extrapolated from Levine's work that if a person's natural killer cell activity was normal, no disease would be present. If the NK cell activity was around 50%, indications of subclinical disease would appear. NK cell activity of less than 50% meant that in all likelihood, the person had a chronic illness. As Mikovits, Rossetti, Silverman, and Lombardi began to develop and research their idea of a retrovirus at the heart of ME/CFS, the illness no longer looked like a catch-all, but more like a cellular diaspora, with everything fanning out from the central element of retroviral infection and NK cell problems. If a person's NK cells functioned normally, the retrovirus would stay suppressed. This pattern was also observed in HTLV-1, the retrovirus found mainly in Asian countries that caused leukemia or HTLV-associated myelopathy in about 5% of the patients who carried it. Retroviruses didn't have to be as fast and furious as HIV, directing a person toward certain death if left untreated. But such drama tended to grip public attention. Although people liked to focus on vicious-seeming viruses like Ebola, those didn't actually present a long-term threat. Their very lethality meant that they would burn quickly through a population, killing swaths of people, but eventually extinguishing themselves. HIV had been a cataclysmic scenario, showing that a retrovirus could coexist with its victims for many years, eluding the attention of the immune system, and yet still result in lethal chronic diseases. Mikovits thought of the admonition by famed scientist James Lovelock: an inefficient virus kills its host. A clever virus stays with it. HIV was not just a driver, but a hijacker. If a retrovirus was at the heart of ME/CFS and autism, it seemed to lower immune functions of the patient enough to allow the proliferation of other pathogens, but not completely sabotage immunity to cause imminent death, dialing down functionality just enough so the pathogen could survive, but making the daily life of the host much more difficult. Those with the virus suffered greatly, but since the medical profession couldn't get a clear read on the problem because of conflicting signals from other pathogens and biomarkers, as well as the baffling array of symptoms, patients were disbelieved or ignored. The patients had to linger in their own private hell with this clever virus directing the course of their lives. Mikovits and Frank and Sandy Rossetti first presented their evidence to the federal government that a retrovirus might underlie many childhood neurodevelopmental disorders in early September 2009 at the NCI. Besides the detailed July 22nd meeting, two other special XMRV conferences happened that involved Mikovits and the public health community prior to the publication of their article in the journal Science on October 8, 2009. Each meeting gave public health authorities time to review the work and identify any weaknesses in the original data or concerns they might have had about the research conclusions before the publication of any data. The level of caution seemed fail-safe. Frank Rossetti, as a government employee, was slated to present the data on the two children with Niemann-Pick type C disorder. When the two children's results for natural killer cells and antibodies were matched against the results from ME/CFS patients, they looked remarkably similar. Frank also presented evidence from several children with autism, showing abnormal gag sequences from viral proteins thought to be associated with XMRV, as well as data showing that the children's plasma could transmit what appeared to be a retrovirus into LNCAP cell line. He included data from the family members, showing an apparent familial pattern of both immune system abnormalities and neuroimmune disorders. What impressed Mikovits the most about the September meeting was how seriously the public health establishment responded to this information. A number of researchers from the NCI had attended. John Coffin was there, as well as a smattering of career retrovirologists. Also in attendance at the meeting was an HIV researcher and antiretroviral drug specialist who had once worked with Mikovits. XMRV and the apparently associated diseases created a loud rallying cry in the research community, convening great minds and significant forces to combat it. In that air of optimism, Annette Whittemore also had a visible agenda. She proposed to the scientists in charge of the research funding to the extramural community at the NCI and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, NIAID, the institute in charge of overseeing infectious disease research, that the WPI be made a center of excellence and secure separate funding to study these diseases. While the attendees seemed to comprehend that a timely reaction to the growing epidemic was imperative, they emphasized that there were channels to go through to secure research funding, and resented, like most bureaucrats, a non-scientist attempting to circumvent the process. Annette Whittemore hit a wall with a senior grants administrator of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, that was directed by Dr. Anthony Fauci. Fauci was a notorious foe-turned-friend to many people with AIDS in the early years of the pandemic, when his later friend Larry Kramer, the well-known activist and writer with AIDS, called him a murderer. Fauci had his own critics in the ME/CFS community, especially over his 2002 decision to move research for ME/CFS from the National Institutes of Health to the Office of Research on Women's Health. One activist wrote of the decision, "A major concern of CFS sufferers has been the tendency of society to quickly classify emerging illnesses which predominantly affect women as psychiatric, stress-related, behavioral, or emotional dysfunction." Mikovits felt that the senior grants administrator spoke in a seemingly condescending tone when she explained that Annette didn't understand how the American research culture worked. The National Institutes of Health would put out a call for proposals. It would then take about 3 or 4 years for the proposals to come back from the various researchers in the field and institutions. After such time, the medical intelligentsia would decide which submissions should be recommended to the appropriate research agencies. From the picture presented by the senior grants administrator, it appeared the federal government would jump right on this potential public health crisis in about 5 years. This meeting, in addition to some of the early critical response to the science paper, drove Annette and Mikovits to make a brash move by appearing on the Nevada Newsmakers show. Nevada Newsmakers opened with punchy music, colorful graphics, and the announcer promising a no-holds-barred political forum. Host Sam Shad spoke in a soothing voice as he began. "I can't think of a more exciting program I've done because what we're about to talk about is world-shattering news." Shad recounted the recent publication of the Science article and the association between a newly discovered retrovirus, XMRV, and patients with ME/CFS. Mikovits began in the confident tones of a professional who had spent decades in medical research. "There are only two other human retroviruses known, human T-cell leukemia virus and HIV, the retrovirus that causes AIDS. Both of these viruses cause cancers, neurological disorders, and inflammatory diseases in man." Shad asked what had prompted them to look for this retrovirus in patients with ME/CFS, when it had previously only been reported in men with prostate cancer, a seeming leap. Mikovits noted that the hereditary prostate cancer gene number 1, HPC1, coded for an antiviral enzyme RNase-L, and that this enzyme was also deficient in patients with ME/CFS. The host solicited Annette Whittemore's thoughts when the research veered down this unexpected path. Annette replied, "I knew the one thing we had to do was look for answers, and I believed all along we were going to find an underlying pathogen. It didn't make sense that so many different viruses had been claimed to cause this disorder. I was absolutely thrilled. This is exactly what we started out to do." Then Shad broached a hot-button issue, addressing the oft-mistreatment of ME/CFS in the medical community. Annette fielded the question. "The exciting thing is that Judy can tell you how the virus works and every one of those symptoms makes sense. It's wonderful to be able to have this puzzle. Just all the pieces come together and fit so well." Mikovits also launched into the science. "It's a simple retrovirus, which means its expression, the on or off switch, is controlled by just, and we've learned this, it's unpublished data, by just three things. the response to hormones and the response to inflammatory cytokines. It's called NF-kappa-B element. Cortisol, which is the stress hormone, turns on the virus very rapidly and continues to have it expressed. So do inflammatory events as caused by other pathogens. And so do hormones like androgens and progesterone, which also makes sense with regard to prostate cancer. Shad then asked trenchantly, how could the retrovirus be transmitted? Annette replied the other two known human retroviruses were unable to become airborne and were transmitted through blood and other bodily fluids. Then the conversation turned into interesting territory. Shad observed that the station had been vigorous supporters of the autism community and asked how this research might affect autism. Mikovits replied, "It's not in the paper and it's not reported," she said, "but we've actually done some of these studies and found the virus present in a significant number, of autistic samples that we've tested so far." Shad said the news had tremendous potential for parents looking for treatments or cures for their autistic children. Mikovits replied by saying that XMRV might be linked to a number of neuroimmune diseases, including autism. It certainly won't be all, because there are genetic defects that result in autism, but there are also the environmental effects. Then, with barely taking a breath, she crossed the Rubicon. "There's always the hypothesis that my child was fine, then they got sick, and then they got autism." Interestingly, on that note, if I might speculate a little bit, this might explain why vaccines lead to autism in some children, because these viruses live and divide and grow in the lymphocytes, the immune response cells, the B and T cells. So when you give a vaccine, you send your B and T cells into overdrive. That's its job. Well, if you're harboring one virus and you replicated a whole bunch, you've now broken the balance between the immune response and the virus. So you could have had the underlying virus and then amplified it with the vaccine and then set off the disease, such that your immune system could no longer control the infections and create an immune deficiency. The segment broke for commercial. After break, Shad announced that Annette and Mikovits wanted to clear up an issue about vaccines. Annette spoke up. "I just wanted to say that we are certainly advocating vaccinations and understand how important they are to the well-being of the children. But what we're hoping for is by finding out whether or not somebody is positive for XMRV, whether it's one family member or another, and then looking for it in children, you could alter the immune response in such a way that you can protect the child and still be able to vaccinate and avoid autism in these kids. And again, I don't think either one of us are sitting here and saying vaccinations cause autism rather than a number of factors. The genetic susceptibility to the illness, the infection itself, and then on top of that, you're adding something to that mix that takes the child over the top." Shad then jumped to the hopeful topic of drug treatments, stating that HIV/AIDS was once a death sentence that was overturned once current treatments allowed people with HIV/AIDS to live long and healthy lives. Mikovits quickly interjected that there were existing FDA-approved drugs that might also be effective in combating the XMRV retrovirus, and believed the time was right to begin rational clinical trials. Shad said this was going to be an exciting global breakthrough, and he was thrilled by the potential, as he had a family member with the excruciating nerve pain of fibromyalgia. Annette added that they had been studying fibromyalgia and found those patients were also testing positive for XMRV in high numbers. The segment ended. On November 9th and 10th, 2009, Silverman hosted a workshop on XMRV at the prestigious Cleveland Clinic. It was the first workshop on XMRV at the facility internationally renowned for its innovative, forward-thinking approaches and therapies. In an air of levity and sportsmanship, he even had black baseball caps with XMRV emblazoned across the front made for the attendees. Silverman had been one of the lead researchers on the team that first discovered pieces of the retrovirus in prostate cancer tissue, and the Cleveland Clinic could reasonably lay claim to a fair share of the credit for the discovery of XMRV in ME/CFS, even though others like Joseph DeRisi had contributed with the use of his Virochip diagnostic test. Silverman and Lombardi had been professional pals since that meeting the previous year at the Michael Milken prostate cancer event when they hiked the Sierra Nevadas. Mikovits considered it a positive sign that, even though their work had cast considerable doubt on Silverman's assertion of a link between a specific genetic variation in the RNase L gene and infection with the XMRV retrovirus, it had not damaged their collegial relationship. The association between a defect in the RNase L antiviral enzyme and XMRV infection in ME/CFS was still very robust. They simply hadn't identified the genetic variation, which was responsible for the defect in the enzyme. Maybe it wasn't even a problem that could be blamed on genetics. Despite some unanswered questions, Silverman invited Lombardi to give a presentation on the RNase L research and the immunology in XMRV-infected ME/CFS patients. He also asked Mikovits to present on the virology in the Science paper, and she prepared both of their talks. At the conference, she and Lombardi met up with Sandy Rossetti, who had co-authored the paper. Mikovits felt confident that Lombardi would expound on his research well, and she was excited for the young postdoctoral fellow presenting data from his first publication. But Mikovits came down with severe laryngitis the day they arrived and couldn't talk above a whisper. So the night before her own presentation, Mikovits reviewed it slide by slide with Lombardi, explaining what to say about each, the transitions, and the questions he might be asked. Frank Rossetti had contributed essentially all of the virology in the paper, and Lombardi the immunology. In retrospect, instead of simply naming Frank Rossetti co-first author, the team probably should have revisited the decision to name Lombardi as a first author on the Science paper after Dean and Gould found that there was no association between the RNase L genetic variation and infection with the XMRV retrovirus. But Mikovits had been in the middle of credit disputes before and didn't have the stomach for them. In her mind, once the decision had been made around authorship, it was settled. John Coffin presided over the event from the stage, sitting behind the table with his arms folded, his wild white hair and thick beard framing his face. Mikovits sat in front of the audience, her throat still raw from laryngitis, a rare transient mutism for the woman nicknamed Tsunami Judy by her friends, for the torrent of words that poured out when she had a pressing thought. In his 15-minute presentation, Lombardi seemed to have little understanding of the virology. He stumbled over the slides and scrambled important information. It was a disaster. Mikovits sat tensely in the audience, trying to hold herself back. The presentation also included a slide on the children with Niemann-Pick syndrome. Including data on children had been a strategic decision. Because ME/CFS sufferers were mostly women, disbelievers and deniers could easily build on a long history of supposed female hysteria. It was one thing, Mikovits and Rossetti reasoned, to ignore sick women, but who would stomp on sick children? During the question and answer session, an audience member noted that Lombardi had mentioned vaccines and asked if these kids had started falling apart after a vaccination. Mikovits thought she had been abundantly clear with Lombardi about answering this question. Although she did not fully understand how starkly the lines were drawn on the question of vaccines, she labored to develop an answer that would acknowledge the importance of vaccines to public health, while at the same time being consistent with the existing evidence that among some children, those same vaccines could cause enormous damage. She had instructed Lombardi to say that they might be dealing with some children who have an inborn genetic defect, which would make it difficult, if not impossible, for them to respond to the immune challenge of a vaccine. Lombardi needed to be clear that they were not talking about any fear that XMRV might be contained in a vaccine, or that anything was wrong with the vaccine. The hypothesis he was supposed to advance was that if these children were harboring a retrovirus, possibly as a result of a genetic defect in their antiviral defense system, the retrovirus would most likely be hiding in the B and T cells of their immune system. The intended effect of a vaccination is to expand the B and T cells of a person's immune system to fight the weakened or killed virus, thus creating antibodies that can protect a person in the event of an actual infection. But in the case of a child who had the retrovirus in their B and T cells, the very immune activation that was supposed to confer immunity for one virus would end up causing this newly discovered retrovirus to replicate. It would look to a parent like they took their healthy child in for a vaccination, and afterwards their child started to develop problems. There was also the very real possibility that as a child's immune system developed, it would control the retrovirus on its own, and the developmental or neurological problems might never occur. The vaccine could be the trigger that tipped the child into immune and neurological problems, but there were other issues. In other words, the argument had a lot of nuances. But Lombardi gave a pat answer. Yes, these children began falling apart after a vaccination. He began to fully explain the hypothesis, but was cut off by hostility from the rear of the room. "You can't say anything about autism," one researcher shouted from the back. "Why are you talking about vaccines?" yelled another. Lombardi responded, "I didn't say it was in the vaccines. I said the vaccines were stimulating the very cells which might be harboring the retrovirus." Mikovits could see Coffin, now on his feet, glaring at Lombardi. Somebody yelled, "Are you saying these retroviruses are in the vaccines?" Lombardi tried to settle the fracas. Researchers typically did not shout over each other like Wall Street traders, but now they were doing just that. This just agitated the attendees. The audience members, particularly from the back, continued to shout. Mikovits tried to defend her collaborator, but her laryngitis prevented her from speaking in anything louder than a whisper. Finally, Silverman calmed the crowd and Lombardi left the stage. Mikovits thought that Coffin's eyes were staring daggers at the young postdoc. A scientist present at the conference confirmed much of what Mikovits reported, but put a different spin on the controversy. "It's left to the listener to determine whether this opinion reflects proper scientific humility in the face of processes which are still unclear, or something which would have been foreign to scientists like Galileo or Darwin, who chose to follow a hypothesis to its conclusion, regardless of who it bothered." About Coffin, the scientist said, "I think he was just concerned. I think all of us were concerned. We didn't want anybody to get upset about something, or think that we had found the answer to something before it was really well investigated. I'm trying to think of the right word. I think he was sensitive to the fact that there's been a lot of controversy about studies on ME/CFS and autism. And I think that's part of the reason we still haven't figured it out. There's so much controversy, and the scientists don't want to get involved in the controversy and do the research. And it's left to people who are maybe not the best researchers to do it. But I think he was concerned, like, don't go there. Indeed, there seemed to be a minefield when it came to autism, and what role, if any, vaccines might play in the disorder. Mikovits and Frank Rossetti debriefed Lombardi's discussion, as well as a separate set of problems raised by Dr. Brigitte Huber, namely her inability to detect XMRV in an ME/CFS cohort. Huber had done some very preliminary work in a handful of ME/CFS samples, using primers and assays quite different from those used by Mikovits, and had been unable to find XMRV, data she brought up pre-publication. Mikovits believed the poor results were because Huber was focusing on Silverman's sequences and PCR conditions, not starting with the spleen focus-forming virus assay, which seemed to her to be the closest match to the new retrovirus. Mikovits also believed Huber was getting funding from the HHV6 Foundation, and often scientists will have an unconscious bias against research which conflicts with their own. If XMRV turned out to be a significant pathogen in the development of ME/CFS and autism, it would displace HHV6 as a possible causal candidate. From an email Mikovits later sent to Silverman discussing what had happened at the conference, "I am sorry that we were both sick and that Vinny said some inappropriate things. He is young and trying his best. I am disappointed that Brigitte Huber was allowed to show very preliminary data and turn our presentation into a circus." Silverman responded by saying that he had declined Huber's request to speak, but then she talked to some other people who agreed to let her speak. Then he talked about the autism data. "The autism data has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, since it is out there on the internet without a peer-reviewed publication, and uninformed people are jumping to conclusions." Mikovits thought it was a little strange to say that the data on autism, the most common childhood developmental disorder, rubbed a lot of the people the wrong way, but she wanted to maintain the forward momentum. Shouldn't this be exciting news? It concerned her that Huber had presented such preliminary data, also unpublished, even after being told no by Silverman. Mikovits responded, "We are going to get all of the autism off of the sites possible today and do damage control as possible." The intent of the slide was as should have been stated, and I did say last week we found it in families. Vinny missed the subtleties, and Frank had felt that these data needed to be presented to scientists, as they do provide clues to transmission so that studies could start as soon as possible. Point well taken. The slide has been burned. Even at this early stage, the outlines of a two-front war were starting to take shape. The first front was on XMRV itself, and how Mikovits believed researchers were choosing to ask a different question than she had done in the Science article. She had found something close to Silverman's XMRV, and it might be exactly that, or it could be something closely related. They were hunting an elusive prey, a virus that might spend most of the time hiding in tissues and not usually be present in the bloodstream. That was why she had taken multiple samples from the patients, looking for that time when the virus could be detected in the blood. It wasn't a one-look proposition. This fight would be very public. The second front, almost a secret war, the one thing nobody seemed to want to talk about, is what this might mean for those with autism. Mikovits would come to believe that powerful forces were fighting on the first front so hard because they didn't want to reveal what this second front meant to a generation of children and their own culpability. After the Cleveland Clinic seminar, Mikovits phoned Frank Rossetti to tell him what a disaster the conference had been. Frank tried to calm her down, telling her it couldn't have been that bad, but he didn't convince her. When Mikovits returned to Nevada and met with Harvey and Annette Whittemore, she told them that in order to protect Lombardi's professional future, they would need to remove him from the research. After the dust-up at the Cleveland Clinic, she'd heard murmurings that Lombardi would not get any other government grants. And Mikovits knew how clannish the research community could be. Lombardi hadn't been working at the research lab much anyway. He spent most of his time in the clinical lab. Mikovits suggested that Lombardi could head up the clinical lab and work part-time in the research lab. If he could not get funding, he could not teach students whose careers depended on academic reputation and grant support. Mikovits saw no other viable solution to keep Lombardi safe. Lombardi would not be allowed to be an academic research scientist, at least for several years. But Lombardi was still interested in doing research. He would work on her grants as a co-investigator and continue to submit research grant proposals to the government with the support of Mikovits and Rossetti. None would be funded. If the presentation had been about a less charged scientific subject, Lombardi might not have received such hostile treatment. But in his first outing, he had grabbed the third rail of Western science, and Mikovits doubted that her colleagues would forgive the heresy. Harvey Whittemore made several phone calls urging Frank Rossetti to meet with Senator Harry Reid to discuss the research and control the damage done by Lombardi's presentation. Despite his misgivings, federal employees are not supposed to meet with congressional representatives unless they get approval, Rossetti eventually accepted. After all, Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, wanted to meet with him and surely had the authority to approve the meeting. Reid noticed Rossetti's Boston accent, asked about his background, how he got into science, his military service, and engaged in other basic small talk. Rossetti did his best to remain charming and engaged. Eventually, Reid asked Rossetti if he thought the research into XMRV was important. Rossetti believed Reid just wanted to know if Rossetti thought if XMRV and ME/CFS research was worthy of more research funding. The autism vaccine question never came up. A photographer came in at one point to take a picture of Senator Reid, Rossetti, and Harvey Whittemore. Harvey and Frank, and then Annette and Frank, posed behind the majority leader's chair with gleaming grins. After the meeting, Harvey and Frank had lunch without Annette, who had some political meeting to attend. During lunch, Frank told Harvey not to sell a diagnostic kit for two reasons. First, the science paper needed to be independently reproduced first, and second, even if it was right, the self-righteous scientific leaders would think it unseemly to make money directly from an individual's discovery. As far as vaccines and how they might contribute to the number one childhood developmental disorder, neither the scientific nor political establishment wanted to go there. ME/CFS was already well-branded, and the patients were, by and large, tucked away in rooms, but autism was far too much of a wild card. Trying to find answers for the millions of children with autism apparently rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Given the lack of interest and even outright hostility expressed by those at the Cleveland Clinic conference on XMRV, it's difficult to understand what part of the public health these scientists were interested in protecting.